Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano, who is joining us remotely from Charlottesville. How are things in Charlottesville, Frank?
Things in Charlottesville are great, David. People are really, really excited because the University of Virginia is in the Final Four of the NCAA basketball tournament. So there's a great deal of excitement locally about that. I noticed that your teams, Duke and North Carolina, are no longer playing. So it must
yes,
be
that is true.
It's a rather unusual circumstance for you.
Well, you know, we try to sort of share the wealth with the people who don't really care. But
Me neither. But people, you ask me how things are locally.
That's what
people are excited about.
Having spent my undergraduate and graduate career at schools that care very deeply about these things, I understand what that's like. Right. So a little bit over a week ago, we got news that Robert Mueller had dropped off his report at the Justice Department, and subsequently, a couple of days after that, received from Attorney General Bill Barr what I guess is not supposed to be a summary anymore, but a four-page synopsis of findings of the Mueller report. And so what we thought we'd talk about today is talk about the history of government reports, in particular named reports like this one.
Yes, students are submitting their dissertations at this time of year, and it's nice to know that Robert Mueller got his in on time.
Oh, yes. Congratulations to history students who turned in their dissertations, which were due today at noon. So congratulations.
At the University of Edinburgh.
Yes, here at the University of Edinburgh. And if you're listening to this and didn't turn in your dissertation, stop listening to it now and turn it in late because late penalties are bad. Right. So the kinds of reports we're talking about, we're going to talk about the Warren Report, the 9/11 Report, Starr Report, all kinds, Pentagon Papers, who knows what else we'll manage to sort of touch upon today. But government reports, we're going to try to see if we can make that topic sexy. Right, so before we sort of dive into the history of sort of the antecedents of the Mueller Report, obviously we haven't read the Mueller Report because nobody except for Bill Barr, as far as I know, has read the Mueller Report. What's your initial take on this position we're in right now, or whether we know the report is done, but we haven't had a chance to read it, Frank?
Well, I think we need to reserve judgment for the obvious reason, as you said, that nobody's read the report. Having said that, I think that it appeared that President Trump and his minions, particularly Barr, Attorney General Barr, had kind of won the politics of this in the first instance because of his four-page letter presenting the Mueller report's findings, allegedly. And then President Trump went out immediately and declared himself completely exonerated, even though Barr's letter says that the report does not exonerate President Trump of obstruction of justice. It is a confusing moment because nobody knows what they're talking about and nobody's read the report. Nonetheless, Twitter and cable news, et cetera, have been obsessed with this thing for now for almost 2 weeks.
If not 2 years.
Indeed. But they seem in the first instance to have bought the Trump administration's spin. What's interesting to me is that the polls haven't moved. Indeed, if they've moved in any direction, it's been against President Trump on this. The most recent polling that was released in the past couple of days shows that people want to see the whole report and they don't trust the response that or the summary. I know we're not supposed to call it that, but Attorney General Barr's summary. And so it appears it's a bit like a sugar high that the Trump administration ate a lot of candy a week or so ago and declared victory. The press went along with it, seemingly, especially on Fox News, but not only Fox News, for a few days. But it doesn't seem to have really moved the needle very much. And so I think we have to reserve judgment, frankly. I don't think and that includes people who are both praising and criticizing Robert Mueller. We simply have not read his report yet. And until we do, we have to reserve judgment.
I think you're right about that. I mean, it's like Schrodinger's cat, though, right now. Well, we know there may or may not be something in the report. We just have to wait until we get access to it. If we ever do get access to it, and that, I think, remains something of an open question.
I think we will see it. Are you skeptical?
Well, so, I mean, the question is, you know, will we see it? How much of it we will see and when will we see it? My understanding at present is that Attorney General Barr has promised within the next 2 weeks or so to released a redacted version of the report, but I think as anyone who's worked with classified government materials knows, the question is, you know, how much redaction takes place and how much do we get to see behind, you know, what the actual report is. I know there's been a number of congressional committees who have they're trying to get their hands on the original unredacted report. I think one of them actually had a deadline of today for the Attorney General to hand it over, although I don't think he's going to do that. So I think there'll be a fight over you know, executive privilege and who gets to read the report. Will we get to read the report in its totality? Sure, but that may not be, you know, this year or this decade. I'm hoping we get to see all of it soon, but I think that still remains up in the air.
I think we will, because I just think the attention and pressure will be too great, and it's entirely possible someone will leak it. And
which has antecedents, and we'll talk about that.
Yes, and we'll get to that. So I think it could well be leaked if it's not officially released. And the other thing, and this kind of goes to our theme today, these reports, while they are always produced in a particular political moment, are almost always as well produced with an eye on posterity. And so I think, you know, as historians, we're used to taking a longer view. I think this will come out, and I think it will come out sooner rather than later in some form or other. And but I think it's been written with the long view in mind. Now, again, I haven't seen the report, so how do I know? That's just my speculation on the nature of these reports as a genre, which might be the right way to start to, or the right moment to turn and start thinking about them today for the podcast.
So if we're going to sort of trace this back, where would we find sort of the origins of the great-great-great-grandfather of the Mueller report?
Well, listeners, you may think we don't prepare for this podcast, but we do. And David and I were chatting off air, and he asked me when the first congressional report was issued. Well, when I say we don't prepare, but we do, I should really say David. And I had to confess I didn't know. And David said to me, "It's 1792. Do you want to guess what it is?" Of course, this is my period, and so I start to guess, and I made a guess or two which were incorrect, and you'll have to wait for the director's cut to hear what I had to say. But then David revealed, put me out of my misery, and said there was a congressional report in 1792 into Arthur St. Clair's defeat at the hands of the Native Americans in what's today Ohio, which was a great defeat inflicted on the United States.
Arguably the greatest defeat the U.S. military has ever faced in combat.
Well, at the hands of Native Americans, certainly, yeah.
In terms of a single battle, because I think they lost almost, there was some, the casualty rate was something astronomical.
It's over 80%. St. Clair's defeat is very, very bad, and it's a humiliation inflicted on the government by indigenous peoples in the Northwest. Yeah. It's an important moment in the history of the early republic, and there was a congressional inquiry into that. And so that's the first congressional report. They found St. Clair to be at fault, which was probably accurate. And so that is the first of these. Then there's a spate of these congressional reports. I mean, there are reports to Congress and issued by Congress, I guess, pretty consistently throughout history. But these kind of reports on particular events or in response to events are somewhat rarer. And there was a spate of them, David, in your period around the Reconstruction. Do you want to say something about this?
Before we do that, I think one thing I think it's worth mentioning, people sort of think about, sort of why is Congress, and most of the ones in the 19th century are congressionally organized investigations, you know, why is Congress investigating things? So where is that found sort of constitutionally? And the constitutional framework for it is if they're going to make laws, and this sort of ties it back to the history of Parliament and whatnot, going back to the late Middle Ages. You know, if they are going to make laws, they need investigatory powers in order to make sure they're making the best laws. And so that's where the sort of constitutional premise for Congress's subpoena power and other kinds of investigatory tools. So there are a number of these in the mid-19th century. There's a select committee that's appointed after John Brown's raid in Harper's Ferry. So in 1857, there's this select committee to inquire into the facts of the recent invasion of the U.S. Armory at Harper's Ferry, where they conclude basically that John Brown, a bunch of guys, sees the armory, as I think everyone knows that particular story. One of the things about, though, that investigation, and I think in a lot of these investigations, is they position themselves as fact-finding investigations, where their purpose is not to, you know, pursue a particular agenda, but to discover the truth and what have you. What becomes very clear in both the Harper's Ferry case and a lot of these cases is they're very deeply political. One of the things the Harper's Ferry investigation found was that John Brown was supported by some financiers in the North who helped to raise the money for the raid. And Southern congressmen said, great, now we have evidence that Northerners are out to get this. We're going to publish thousands of copies of this report to make sure that everybody knows who's responsible for this. Right? And so it becomes very politicized early on. There's a big set of reports in the Civil War era from the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War. This is a joint congressional committee that basically, while the war is going on, checks, you know, it sort of analyzes events as they happen. So they, you know, after the Union defeat at Bull Run, they call generals in, they call off various officers in to testify about what happened and why certain things happened in the battle, and why the Union lost that particular conflict. And you can see later on in the war a series of other investigations. You know, where the Congress is really sort of checking the power of the executive to conduct the war. And these are, I think, really important politically at the time, but they've also been amazingly useful for historians studying the war, because then you actually do get people, you know, doing active investigations into things like the massacre at Fort Pillow, in which African-American soldiers were massacred. And there's a congressional investigation into that, and they produce a lot of the documents we now use to sort of reconstruct these events come from those kinds of investigations. There's a big investigation in the 1870s into the Klan in the South. It's the Select Committee on Investigations on Alleged Outrages in the Southern States, in which they bring lots of Klan victims to D.C. to testify to their experiences. And so it's a phenomenally important historical record for people to use to really understand what was happening on the ground.
So, I mean, that goes to the observation I made a minute ago about the Mueller report, that its significance when we see it might be more for historians and people trying to reconstruct what happened during the Trump administration than as a kind of political tool during the Trump administration.
One of the differences, I think, between those kinds of congressional investigations, though, and what's going on with Mueller, is Mueller has positioned himself as being sort of a, and has been described on both sides at various points in time, depending on what they think he's going to say, as a kind of neutral arbiter, as somebody who is sort of above politics. Whereas, you know, the people who are engaged in the investigation into Harper's Ferry or the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War, or, you know, the investigation, these guys are you know, active partisan politicians who are engaging in it. And so I think there's a different valence to it as a consequence.
Right. So the equivalent of it would be if the Mueller report had been compiled not by Robert Mueller, but by, say, Adam Schiff, the Democrat who's leading the Intelligence Committee right now.
Exactly. I think that's right.
Right.
You know, when we get to the 20th century, because I think there's some the real antecedents for the Mueller report are in the late 20th century. But when we think of the early 20th century, I think one that's a report that's really important is the Nye Committee report in the 1930s, where we can see the report not only it being important in terms of its what it finds, but in terms of how it shapes future policy. This was a committee that was headed by Gerald Nye, who was a Republican from North Dakota, and he was investigating U.S. entry into the First World War. And the committee concluded basically that the U.S. munitions industry really pushed for U.S. entry into the First World War.
I mean, the Eisenhower, of course, hasn't coined the phrase military-industrial complex yet, but essentially that's what Nye was implicating. He called them the merchants of death, as I recall. Is that correct?
I think that sounds right. I'm thinking about, this report comes out in 1936 and was very influential, I think, in the isolation movement in the United States during the late 1930s. So, people who were opposed to U.S. entry into the Second World War pointed to the Nye Committee report and said, look, we don't want to have that happen again. We don't want to sort of fall victim to being dragged into a war that's benefiting a handful of arms merchants against the lives and interests of the American people. And so I think that's one of the, these reports that actually has a really meaningful outcome in terms of shaping public opinion and shaping policy.
Yep, that's right. And then the Nye report is interesting in that it's the first of what we might call the named reports,
exactly.
Which will become one of the characteristics of the 20th century, as we'll see. But the Nye report was really, really important in terms of, as you say, shaping policy. So that's one where I think it reflected back on a historic event of 20 years previously, but it shaped the policy of the United States in its immediate aftermath. So 28 years after the Nye report, we get the arguably one of the most famous of the so-called named reports, the Warren Commission report, which was issued in September of 1964. And the Warren Commission was a commission established by President Johnson to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy, Johnson's predecessor. I think this is interesting in a number of ways. One is that the Warren Commission was set up to investigate Kennedy's death, but also really to head off a lot of the conspiracy theories that were circulating and about Kennedy's death, and frankly that have circulated ever since. And so the Warren Commission report, I think, was always intended to be made public. Indeed, to address these public concerns about conspiracy. So it's very unlike some of the other reports we're going to talk about, including the Mueller report. I mean, I think Donald Trump would prefer that the Mueller report is not made public. He'd rather go with Barr's summary and just say, I'm in the clear. But the Warren Commission actually, I think, was created with addressing the public's concerns as one of its foremost objectives. And so I think it was quite different. And the Warren Commission concluded, it's a very lengthy report, but concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Interestingly, it doesn't seem to have done much to stop the people who believe in conspiracies. Indeed, it's arguably fueled conspiracies because people have said the Warren Commission was a cover-up.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you read the Warren Report?
I tried to read it when I was a kid. Interestingly, about these reports, my parents had them all.
These were
published, and they were bestsellers, and they were standards. So when I was about, 14, I tried to read the entire Warren Commission report, but I got bored.
Pages,
yeah, it's incredibly long, and it's incredibly dense.
Yeah.
I've not read it in its entirety.
I think you're probably in very good company there, because I think it was I think the point I was sort of obliquely making is this was a report that lots of people had access to. It was a bestseller. I've been in lots of houses where you can see it on people's bookshelves, and I'm sure they flip through it, but I'm not sure anyone's reading it exhaustively. I think is the purview of the Kennedy conspiracists more than anybody else. Thinking about the Warren Report as an antecedent for Mueller, there's a couple of things that strike me. One, that is that the person at the head of the commission, Earl Warren, was at the same time Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So they're appointing a ostensibly neutral political actor, a well-respected figure in Washington, to lead the investigation. They call in hundreds of witnesses. The Warren Commission was conducted in private, and some people who are aficionados of this point out that it was not quote-unquote secret the way that the Mueller investigation was, but it was done sort of privately behind closed doors. That may be a distinction without a difference. But, you know, it is a sort of report that got some of its gravitas from you know, the way in which the commission itself was put together. You know, Gerald Ford, I think, was, for instance, on the commission. And he was the, I guess, the Republican minority leader at the time. Not long after the Warren report, I guess we get the Moynihan report, which is a sort of different kind of government report, but one I think that's been both famous and infamous. Do you want to give the synopsis version for those people who haven't read the Moynihan report, which is somewhat shorter and easier to read? But
yeah, I mean, the Moynihan report is an interesting document in a number of ways. It wasn't issued in response to a particular historic event, but rather took a historic look at what was perceived as a social problem at the time. And so the report was issued by, was the main author of the report was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who in the future would be a senator from New York, but at the time was the Assistant Secretary of Labor. And it was a sort of sociological look. The title of the report, and the, you know, the its age is revealed in the title, is The Negro Family. And what Moynihan was looking at was the what was perceived as the crisis in African-American families, particularly single-parent families, or the prevalence of single-parent families, or the apparent prevalence of single-parent families in predominantly black neighborhoods, in urban neighborhoods. And this was seen as a great social problem. And Moynihan, who by training was a sociologist before he became a politician, argued that this these family structures had their origins in slavery and the experience of African Americans after emancipation. It's a controversial report in a number of ways, not least that here you had a middle-class white man explaining the problems as he perceived them of the black family to African Americans. And so it's hard to imagine the government issuing a similar report today, I think.
It's an interesting, because I mean, I think his intention, you know, was to be sympathetic with the experience of African Americans in poverty. But the report has these kind of both, you know, racist overtones to it, and you can read it, I think, in a number of different ways. It inspired a bunch of historical scholarship that tried to debunk sort of some of the central claims. One of the more famous of which is Herbert Gutman's book The Black Family in Slavery and Freedom, which makes an argument that African Americans actually, you know, did have robust family structures that Moynihan described as being you know, destroyed by slavery and created. He describes it as a pathology. So it's an interesting report to read, both for understanding that historical moment in 1965, but also for understanding the period, you know, the two centuries before it. It was instrumental, though, I think, in pushing the Johnson administration towards the war on poverty. I think that's the one of the frameworks to understand it. It was, you know, he was trying to describe black poverty and try to find a historical understanding of it to create a policy solution in the future. So it's important in that respect.
Indeed, I mean, it's a landmark, and as you say, it's a landmark historiographically, if inadvertently. So it's important in a number of ways, possibly not necessarily intended by Assistant Secretary Moynihan at the time.
Yeah, to be sure.
But you're right; it did shape policy. So in that sense, it's a bit like the Nye report. In that it had an immediate impact on government policy, which can't really be said about most of the other reports. I guess, well, we'll get to it. The 9/11 report did shape policy as well. But most of these other famous reports that we talk about from the late 20th century are political statements in many respects, but they don't necessarily shape policy.
How would we fit the Pentagon Papers into this rubric that that we're creating here about reports? Because it's a different kind of beast, I think, than some of these other reports.
Yeah, in the first instance, because the Pentagon Papers were leaked and published by newspapers, and the other reports were issued, released by the government and released deliberately. And so the Pentagon Papers are different in that respect. I mean, the Pentagon Papers examine the history of American involvement in the Vietnam War and in conflicts in Southeast Asia. It was compiled in secret in 1967 and leaked in 1970.
It was started in 1967.
Right.
I think that's right. They didn't, it was Robert McNamara when he was attorney or when he was Secretary of Defense, commissioned it then, but I don't think they actually completed the report, which is thousands of pages long.
Yes. And a lot of it is what we would now consider raw intelligence, as it were. Mm. I mean, it's a treasure trove of primary sources for historians of the Vietnam War. But it's an attempt to, if you will, compile the documents that explain the history of American involvement in the war. But it was very much meant for internal consumption. I don't think it was ever intended for public consumption, although it was, they were eventually leaked. The report, if we can call it such, was eventually leaked and published by the press.
Yeah. When it was originally published by the government for internal use, they published 15 copies. So I think that tells you about their planned circulation. But one of these copies was leaked by Daniel Ellsberg, who was working, I think, for the RAND Corporation or something, to the New York Times, and then it sort of blew up in all kinds of ways.
I mean, do we think, again, we've been inspired to have this conversation by the Mueller report. We don't know how many copies of the Mueller report there are. Of course, this is a very different time technologically. It doesn't matter how many there are, in the sense that
if you have one digital copy, you have an infinite number of digital copies.
That's right. And so I'm sure that Robert Mueller has saved it somewhere in the cloud.
Okay, so I'm sure there are Russian hackers looking for it, or not.
They probably already got it. They got it from the president. Jeez. Joking. No collusion.
I think, just thinking about the story of Ellsberg, he had to sort of smuggle out bits and pieces of the Pentagon Papers to photocopy, because, that was the technological world he lived in. Now, obviously, we know there's at least one copy of the Mueller report that's in Bill Barr's office, but how many more copies are out there? We'll find out. But whether anybody leaks it, if anyone from the Justice Department is out there listening to this, and I doubt there is, lots of people consider Daniel Ellsberg a hero. You can be a hero. Just saying.
You could be a hero.
I'm not urging people here to violate federal law, but you could be a hero.
One thing that will have to be reckoned with, I suspect, is counterfeit Mueller reports.
Oh, yes.
I mean, so the government may be forced to release the Mueller report because undoubtedly there are mischief makers and online trolls producing
mock-ups. Fake versions of the Harry Potter books that came out before the Harry Potter books came out, and I'm sure there's, a comparable analogy for fake government report, somebody who can try to write in the style of Bob Mueller. See what kind of plot twists there are on those ones. We've got a bunch of interesting government reports. I think that the ones that are probably the most direct antecedents, though, for the Mueller report are the Starr report in 1998 and the 9/11 report in 2004.
Oh, don't forget, David, before that, in 1987, was the Tower Commission
report.
Oh,
the Tower Commission report, yeah.
Into Iraq.
Want to remind people about the Tower Commission, because I think that's also – actually, all three of these, I think, are really interesting antecedents.
I think they're all relevant antecedents in different ways. So the Tower Commission report was a report into the so-called Iran-Contra affair, which was a fairly big deal during the Reagan administration, and the Iran-Contra affair was involved selling arms to the Contras in Nicaragua and taking the proceedings and sending money to Iran. It's a very complicated, tangled tale, but both the Contras were controversial. Iran after the revolution was certainly controversial, and funding the opposition in Iran was an issue. There was all kinds of – it's a cloud over the Reagan administration, and the Tower Commission report in 1987 was intended to untangle this fairly messy controversy, and didn't really succeed in doing so, but it did shed some light on it. But it was interesting. I think it's germane because it was a report commissioned to deal with an ongoing controversy, which was dogging an administration. And so to some extent, I think it's an antecedent to the Mueller report. I think there are some equivalencies there that make it important. The Starr report – sorry, go ahead, David.
Well, I was just thinking the Tower report may be more akin to some of the investigations that are going on in Congress right now.
Yes, okay.
Because that's right. You know, in as much as they are sort of investigating not events in the past, in the sort of distant past, like say that the Nye Committee was, or these other things that are, but investigating sort of active government activities, you know, the way that the illegally sending arms to the Contras, which Congress had prohibited the government from doing, and you know, Oliver North, all that kind of nonsense. All right, so we got the Tower report. We got what's next is the
Starr report in 1998, and the Starr report, I think Republicans might paradoxically argue the Mueller report is a bit like the Starr report in the sense that, although they're loath to admit this, the Starr report was very much, it began as an investigation into the Clintons, both Clintons, investment in the Whitewater. Whitewater was a very complicated, very dull land deal in Arkansas when the Clintons were in when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas, and Republican opponents of President Clinton really sought to exploit this for political gain and to find some sort of evidence of malfeasance. They never really did, in part because nobody understands Whitewater, but that metastasized under Kenneth Starr, who was the special prosecutor investigating it, into an investigation of, among other things, Bill Clinton's sex life and his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And it went into very, very great graphic detail about said subject in ways that most government reports do not. And so the Starr report, when it was issued in 1998, fueled the impeachment of Bill Clinton in that year, but ultimately was seen as a kind of overreach by the opposition. And I think that, and as a partisan exercise. And again, I haven't seen Republicans making this direct connection, because they would mean kind of criticizing their former selves. But to some extent, the argument they're making about Mueller, that it's a partisan witch hunt, which is the phrase that President Trump has used quite a bit, could directly be applied to describe the Starr report. And so to some extent, I think it acts as an antecedent to Mueller, even if Republicans don't want to admit that.
In some ways, the Starr report was, I don't want to compare these maybe, but seems like more of a witch hunt in a way, where he was commissioned originally to investigate one topic and then ends up investigating seven or eight different topics. You know, he investigates they fire people in the White House travel office, and they investigate that for a while. They investigate the Paula Jones situation. The Starr report, you know, it took 4 years to compile that. So it actually took longer than the Mueller report did. And they delivered to Congress, and Congress almost immediately, and I think this is an interesting difference, the Starr report reported directly to Congress. And so Congress initially got access to it instead of reporting it to the Justice Department the way that the Mueller report is. And I think there's structural reasons with the way that the independent counsel law has evolved over time to explain that difference. But Congress then immediately voted to release it to the public. And I think the vote was 363-63. So there's an overwhelming number of congressmen decided to release it to the public. And it was sold in like Barnes and Noble. Like it was a best-selling report, much like the Warren report was beforehand. So it was a publicly consumed document. And I think some people read it because they were interested in politics and corruption, and I think most people read it because they wanted the scandalous sex stuff. I don't think the Mueller report's going to have anything quite like that. We'll find out.
Well, we don't know. We don't know. I mean, I suspect not. And one thing that, that Mueller did while compiling his report, of course, was he did hive off certain strands or themes or topics, I guess, to, among others, the Southern District of New York Attorney's Office to investigate. And those are matters that might be criminal. And so what, and I'm basing this on the reporting, so I could well be wrong, but the sense one gets is that rather than growing, that Robert Mueller's investigation became more focused, and when it discovered malfeasance that wasn't directly related to what he was investigating, he kind of hived that off to others, whereas the Starr report was the opposite. It just grew and included almost everything related to Bill Clinton. And Ken Starr became sort of a grand inquisitor investigating all matters relating to Bill Clinton's malfeasance, real and imagined.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, one difference is that I think Mueller knows that his report's going to be filtered through the Attorney General's office, hence the four-page non-summary letter, whatever it is. Whereas I think Ken Starr knew, in part because he had more power as an independent counsel, investigate both whatever he wanted to, with his budget as large as he wanted it to be. But he also knew he'd have wouldn't get this line of filter before it went to Congress and went to the American people. How about the 9/11 Commission? Does that fit in form our understanding then of Mueller?
A little bit. I mean, I think the 9/11 report is a bit more like the Tower Commission report, or the Warren Commission, or even the Nye report, or frankly, even the original 1792 investigation into St. Clair's defeat, sense that it's an attempt by it's a congressional report. It's an attempt to come to grips with the intelligence failures that contributed to the 9/11 attacks. And what it finds is that there isn't a lot of joined up thinking between the myriad intelligence agencies that the United States has. And it recommends, and Congress acts on this, to rectify that problem by creating a more unified intelligence structure. And so it's a bit like I said, the Warren Commission, and its address to the public is trying to explain to a public that's very, very feeling very vulnerable in 2004 when it's issued, to explain what happened. But it also has policy implications, not unlike the Nye report or the Moynihan report. So it fulfills a number of these criteria, or in terms of the its antecedents. I'm less persuaded because we don't know what's in the Mueller report as to its correlation with the Mueller report. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm with you on the 9/11 report, which was also a bestseller that you know sold in bookstores around the country and whatnot, and available for. I think that was one of the first reports you could download, so you could read it on your computer. I think that was a report that was both intended to inform the American public about what was going on, whereas I think the Mueller report is really intended with an audience of. With a very different kind of model of who the audience is, potentially. There were some very distinct policy outgrowths of the 9/11 report, the fact that the sort of FBI and the CIA didn't talk to each other at all, and I think that sort of contributed to, or they the report concluded that it contributed to 9/11, the creation of the National Security Director post to oversee both agencies. Yeah, but we will see in terms of how it relates when we eventually do get to see that the Mueller report. Right. Well, we will hold our breaths and waiting for the Mueller report to drop.
I wouldn't, David. You could pass out before it comes out, so don't hold your breath.
Okay, don't hold it. We will metaphorically hold it. until that happens. Right, time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I've got two. It is It's Tartan Week here in the United States, David. So I will be
tartan
heading
Tartan Week?
To...
I thought it was a Tartan Day. It's now
Well,
a
Tartan
week.
Day is Saturday. No, it's always been a week. In fact, they've rebranded Tartan Week as or Tartan Day as Scotland Day because nobody knows what tartan is in the United States. It is Tartan Week in the United States and culminating in Tartan Day on Saturday the 6th. I will be in New York marching in the Tartan Day Parade on Saturday the 6th. If any of our listeners want to join me and join the University of Edinburgh delegation, you would be welcome to do so. We will be gathering outside the Algonquin Hotel, Ooh. Which is at 59 West 44th Street, at 1:30 on Saturday. The parade sets off at 2. We will march up the Avenue of the Americas. There will be... it will be the experience of your life. So any and all listeners are welcome to join us. I promise you, you will have fun. And so we've got that to look forward to. But my real last drop, as it were, you can't have two last drops, is directed at you in the form of a question. So there was a controversy this week about Nike had a had an ad campaign, and the headline of it was Lost Cause. The argument of the ad, which was pulled for reasons which will become apparent in a moment, the argument of the campaign was that people should get lost. Nobody gets lost anymore because of we're all interconnected and online all the time. And basically it was more or less take your running shoes and go get lost. The use of the phrase lost cause caused a great deal of controversy, especially on what might be dubbed Civil War Twitter, which I think you're familiar with.
I am, yes.
And there was a lot of outrage. And within a day, the ad was pulled. And it was pulled because of the political associations of the phrase the lost cause with the kind of neo-Confederate movement in the United States ever since 1865. And my question, which I submit in a spirit of friendship and with respect, is did Civil War Twitter overreact about this? That was my initial – I thought, okay, I think the phrase was ill-chosen, but I thought I've got to ask David this. So this is – my last drop is a question to you, David.
Oh, geez,
in what will become the Cogliano Silkenat report?
On the lost cause.
Did Civil War Twitter overreact to Nike's use of the phrase lost cause? I turn things over to you, David.
All right. So for my listeners who aren't familiar with the origin of the phrase lost cause – it's the term that Confederates used in the post-war period to describe sort of an explanation for Confederate defeat, but embedded within the lost cause are deeply racist ideas about Southern society, about the role of slavery in the South, the role of African Americans, both before the Civil War and after the Civil War. The lost cause was used justify white supremacy and lynching and all other kinds of awfulness. So there's embedded within it is a whole panoply of meanings. It's a term that was originally coined by a journalist, Edward Pollard, who wrote a book in 1865 called The Lost Cause. When Civil War historians talk about the lost cause, they're talking about the veneration for the Confederate flag and putting up monuments to Robert E. Lee et al., which we've talked about at length on the show. So here's my read on what happened. I mean, ad campaigns, especially ad campaigns for companies that are multinational conglomerates and like Nike, these things are not done without thorough vetting, right? They're probably, two dozen people looked at this ad campaign and signed off on it, which baffles me because first that suggests that either they aren't familiar with that historical term, which, is fine. They're advertisement people, not historians. But it also suggests that they didn't bother to Google lost cause. which strikes me as a bit far-fetched. Which assuming that somebody did that, they decided, oh, we can use this anyway. The phrase itself, I think, is one of those things that has some very specific connotations attached to it. And so I don't think people overreacted by saying that this was an inappropriate ad campaign. Now, Nike in the past has also had some other stupid ad campaigns. At one point, they named, there was a shoe that they named after some kind of Greek divinity purpose was sexual violence. It was like the, I don't remember the name of the particular shoe, but they had chosen very badly one of the names of their shoe lines, which suggests that this is actually odd pattern among Nike for making bad choices about how they sort of brand and market their footwear. But what's the, I mean, I don't see why pointing this out is in itself an overreaction. I thought it was our job as historians to point out when people do things that have potential connotations they don't pick up on.
Right. Fair enough. And I agree with you. And look, I'm not defending this ad campaign necessarily. I want to stipulate and make that clear. I don't think it was necessarily pointed out in quite as measured a way as you just said, oh, that's our purpose in this. People didn't say, oh, excuse me, Nike, you might want to rethink this because you may be unaware of these associations. I mean, the tone of the Twitter reaction was a bit more, shall we say, passionate than that.
Well, Nike,
I mean, it worked. They canceled the campaign.
They pulled it down. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the way you get people's attention. As you point out, this is super racist. Maybe not by intention, but by...
Well, one thing you said, which was interesting, you talked about Nike as a multinational corporation. And again, I'm not really... I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I'm not... let's suppose this ad was going to run in the UK and in New Zealand and Australia, other English-speaking countries, where that phrase does not have the same historical resonance.
That's true.
Why can't it be used?
I think it could have been used 50 years ago. Granted, Nike didn't exist 50 years ago, but I think we're living in a globally interconnected world, where if it's written in English and has the words "lost cause" in big letters at the top, even if it's targeted at runners in New Zealand, it's going to be picked up by people everywhere. And I think I would imagine a very tricky thing being an advertising executive today, knowing that you are going to be speaking to a global audience and knowing that you may not pick up on the cultural, resonances everywhere. And so I'm hoping this was done out of ignorance. I'm assuming it was done out of ignorance. Nike as a brand has been, fairly progressive on a number of issues, although not necessarily on labor conditions for its factory workers. But, they supported Colin Kaepernick, throughout that whole controversy. So I'm assuming based on that, that at least the people in Oregon are, not supporters of the lost cause particularly.
Let me ask you this, and this just occurred to me in the context of what you just said. If they'd use "lost cause" as the slogan for their campaign to support Kaepernick, how would you have felt about that? I mean, it would have been a bizarre choice.
That requires some mind bending to figure out how that was going to work. And I'm hoping somebody would.
Well, Kaepernick probably would have pointed it out.
Let me tell you about some history here and explain it. Because I think he's I think he has a fairly robust understanding of the historical moment he's in and what its roots are.
Does it matter? Does it matter that they didn't call that they called it "Lost Cause" and not "The Lost Cause"?
I'd have to go back and look at the pulled ad to answer that question.
Right. Well, I suspect we've given this far too much attention. But I don't know. I thought the Twitter reaction was slightly perverted and a little bit of an overreaction. I'm not supporting the ad campaign. I think it's a stupid idea. But and I agree with you. I can't believe they didn't Google it. But there we are. Anyway, what's your last drop, David?
Well, I'm also going to do two things, and they're going to be somewhat more
You know, we have to rename the last drop if we're going to keep doing multiple things. But anyway.
We're having two drinks, and so, you know, we're anyway. One is something that's just appeared as a, I guess, an artistic creation. They're both artistic creations. One is Historian Trading Cards. Which appeared on Twitter and other places in the past week. This is, of course, opening day for Major League Baseball was earlier this week. And we now have Historian Trading Cards to go along with it. And so they've had trading cards for many of people's favorite historians. So you've got a John Hope Franklin and a C. Van Woodward and some more recent historians. And what I particularly like about the Historian Trading Cards is they try to match the historian with the appropriate card design. So if it's a historian from the 1930s, they have a 1930s era looking baseball card. And if
sorry, David, if I can interrupt by way of explanation for our non-American listeners.
Oh, yes.
Baseball cards are a bit like football trading stickers, Panini stickers, for those of you in the UK familiar with football stickers. But since the early 20th century, there have been baseball trading cards with the
pictures. Since the late 19th century, in fact.
And so these historian trading cards are in that.
And many people, myself included, spent far more, too much time and money collecting such things and caring about them.
Me too.
Do you still have your collection?
No, I am one of those people whose mother got rid of them when I left the house, and this became a source of great of angst for me.
I still have mine.
Yeah, well.
But luckily, you know, they're in my father's house, so
good for you. I've got a very small number that survived.
Okay. And the other thing I want to endorse is an exhibit that is opening in Philly. I think it's just opened in Philadelphia. And it's about it's by a visual artist named Sonia Clark. And it's an exhibit about the Confederate flag, but not the Confederate flag that we're all familiar with, but the Confederate surrender flag. And she's made a monumental reproduction of a Confederate surrender flag, truce flag, that's 15 feet by 30 feet, and she's made a number of other recreations of Confederate surrender. And so it's an exhibit about the idea of Confederate surrender and what it meant 150 years ago and what it means today. And I know lots of people are going to the OAH, which is meeting in Philadelphia. And so if you want a break from the conference, go check out this exhibit, and I'll post a link with the details in the show notes.
Or get on the train and come to New York and march in the Tartan Day Parade.
Well, you can do both.
That's true.
You can do both.
And speaking of Confederate surrender, we need to congratulate you, David, on the publication of your new book yesterday on surrender in the Civil War.
Yes. My book, Raising the White Flag, came out about yesterday, so I'm sure listeners have already pre-ordered all their copies. But if you haven't, it was a fun book to write. I'm hoping it's a fun book to read.
Right. Well, it is. I've read it.
Oh, wow. You're a fast reader.
Great.
Thank you. Well, until next time, Frank, cheers.
Cheers, David. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.